Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome, everybody. You're listening to WEAA-FM, home of the Baltimore Blend, weekdays from 6 to 8 a.m. that I have the pleasure of hosting once a month in a remote. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it is a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. www.mecu.com. We have our roundtable here in the first part of our program, what I've been looking forward to for a while, talking about sequestration, other issues in the news, and how we're covering it, not covering it, and why there's such this why there's such a huge, really in many ways, a philosophical divide in America over who we are. We are joined by E.R. Shipp. E.R. Shipp is Associate Professor and Journalist in Residence in the Department of Communication Studies here at Morgan State University, and 1996 Pulitzer Prize winner for her work, former ombudsman at the Post, for which one of my other guests, Bob Somerby, editor of the Daily Howler, wanted to see her nominated for president when she took that job, and Bob Somerby's in the studio. And Rick Vatz is here. Richard Vatz, of course, professor in the Department of Mass Communication and Communication Studies at Taos University, author of the book, the only authentic book on persuasion, and blogs for
Red
Man. Because the title makes me laugh.
By the way, and also the author of a letter to the Washington Post last week supporting the ombudsman at the Washington Post.
All right. 410-319-8888.
Which position no longer exists.
So it's very easy to support him.
Well, I supported the position of the ombudsman.
No, I understand.
So, E.R., welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks very much.
How are you?
I'm great.
Good.
I wish I could be there in the studio, but the elevator isn't working in the building today.
I know they just fixed it.
Oh, wow.
And we have some breaking news that we can probably talk about tomorrow, the next day. Hugo Chavez just passed away.
Oh.
So that could be some interesting changes happening in Venezuela. We'll talk about that at some other time. But just to let you know, that came across the wire.
Mm. What do you suppose the mourning period will be for that in the United States?
I'm sad that Hugo Chavez died. Let me put it
Are you serious?
Well, let's talk about what we're talking
about. Well, home heating issues have been raised partly because Joe Kennedy is a friend of Mr. Chavez and insists that that's how he's been able to help a lot of New Englanders keep warm in the winter.
With inexpensive oil from Venezuela.
Yeah, all right.
It's true.
I'll take
no conservatives can't stand that somebody on the left wins an election. They just can't stand it. I understand that.
Hugo Chavez. God, give me a break.
Well, anyway. So, here we go. Let me just talk about the two things on my mind about sequestration. We start there and get your thoughts, get our listeners' thoughts at 410-319-8888. Before we jump into what the press has and has not covered in this and how they've covered it, E.R. Shipp, one of the things that strikes me is that this is what we're not talking about really is what the underpinnings of this are, which is a really deep political philosophical divide in America that I think that sequestration shows us, but nobody seems to wrestle with this in a major way in the media.
That's probably because Congress isn't really addressing it either. They know that ultimately the two extreme positions are going to have to move somewhere towards a center where they can compromise. So they're playing games, and it's easier, I think, for media to cover the games rather than to try to dig deeper into what the numbers mean and whether there are some viable options to these extreme positions. We'd rather cover the gamesmanship, even using the phrase kick the can improperly, but that refers to an old kid's game in part. But kick the can we'd rather focus on rather than the hard numbers, the hard differences. I think in the country itself, when this sequestration kicks in, and everybody and his mother literally will be affected, I think in the country we're going to see that there are not such extreme adherence to these positions of no taxation or no elimination or reform, if you want to use that word, of some of the entitlement programs. I think the people are going to just say, let's do what makes sense.
You know, Mark, I haven't spoken to everyone in America in the last week, but I would have to assume the societal confusion is just mammoth at this point, that no one has any idea what's going on with anything. We've gone through one budget crisis after crisis in quotes or not, one crisis after another for the last several years. We have several more. It's like, you know, it's like being out in the ocean and a chain of waves starts coming at you and you duck three of them and there's six more coming. I just can't believe anyone is paying any attention anymore. I don't see any attempt on anyone's part. You said the media has been wrestling with this in a major way. I don't know if the media wrestles with anything in a major way at this point. There's a partisan, a massive partisan divide at the heart of all this that's just overwhelmed the media. There's no attempt to explain. To be honest, there's no attempt to explain anything. I can't believe anyone is still listening. I'm not really trying to follow because you can sort through all the details of the latest crisis and 6 weeks down the road, then the next crisis is coming. And it's just all built around blockheaded tribal inability to cooperate. And, you know, each tribe blames the other tribe. I don't see any intelligent discussion of this going on anywhere. And if you watched Shelley Rose last night with Joe Scarborough versus Paul Krugman, you saw a good example of sort of – I watched the whole thing from 3 to 4 in the morning, and you saw a poorly run discussion, poorly run by Charlie Rose. Charlie was sort of snoozing, getting ready for today's CBS morning show. You know, everyone has to have two shows now. It isn't enough to have one show. You have to have several shows.
And that's the issue.
And it really is the issue. You know, you can't be ready for your evening show if you wasted your time all morning on your morning show. And I don't see anyone trying to explain anything. We're just – our public discourse is a joke, and I can't believe anyone is trying to keep up with it anymore.
Just to make a point on the amount of information available – without getting into who's right and who's wrong. I mean, the sequestration is a very difficult issue for people to understand. Is there or is there not? And I have read both in the New York Times and Washington Post. Is there or is there not discretion available once agencies' funds are cut? You know, I have read yes, there is. I've read no, there isn't. I don't know the answer. You know, because I rely, you know, especially on financial matters, I rely on the Washington Post and the New York Times, and I have read both, that there is discretion and that there is no discretion once the – in other words, there are cuts across agencies. But once those cuts are announced, do the agencies have discretion or do they not?
I have read that there is more discretion starting in the second year. But I don't.
But immediately, apparently, there is no discretion, right?
That's what I have read. But
everything will be cut with the same at the same percentage level within agencies. So you can't pick one program that's totally inefficient and cut that and save something that's better run. They have to cut everything.
Yeah, but everything is not everything. I've read I'm debating because I've read both, that there is discretion within agencies, even though all agencies will be cut. There are
one of the things was covered was that the Republican leadership was attempting to give President Barack Obama the power to do that and the power to make what cuts he wanted within the numbers that they wanted to see. And the Democrats said, no, that's gamesmanship and we're not going to play that game. And the Republicans, they were both playing these games, and so
they were.
But I think that the bottom line issue here, I think, is that the way the media has covered it, people don't know what's going on. I mean, people, right. I think, don't even. I mean, even the when the words started being thrown out, sequestration, right. Most people didn't even know what that meant.
I don't even understand that word as it's used. I know sequester when you think about juries being locked away during deliberations. So when it comes into the discussion this way, it's totally foreign to everybody.
Well, it's the government. The New York Times describes it as the government withdrawing money after Congress releases it.
We're all going to live in the Holiday Inn. That's how I understand it.
What were you saying? I'm sorry.
I was struggling about the holiday income, and I'm trying to figure that one out.
That's when the jury is sequestered.
Going to be living on the street, I think, just seeing it. Won't even be able to afford the Holiday Inn.
But that was the argument the New York Times made.
There are so many different. If you go to something on the internet, for example, like ask.com, you can't even find a clear explanation of what sequester means. I had lunch with some Cuban delegates who visited Morgan last week, and one of those gentlemen said that sequester in Spanish refers to being kidnapped. So maybe we're being kidnapped somehow, or our budget is being kidnapped. Who knows? But sequester normally means to withdraw or to be in seclusion or something like that. So here, or to be seized or something like that. So maybe the budget is being seized. I don't know. Maybe we're all being seized by the craziness of Congress. But to get back to an earlier point, I think even though we don't understand the word, we do understand headlines that we're getting saying that thousands of people are going to be losing jobs or losing a good portion of their income through layoffs and furloughs and all of that. So we may not understand that term, but we do understand that it's about to hit our wallets.
Yeah, it's going to be 700,000 jobs, we're saying, are going to be lost in this sequester.
There's a difference, though, between furloughs and layoffs. I mean, a furlough is not a layoff. A furlough can be a minimum problem.
The furloughs in the federal government will be, in the Department of Defense and other places, will be a day a week for the next...
So 20% of your income is going to be taken away.
For the next several months, at least.
Right.
But the civilian population in the Defense Department is gigantic. And so, I mean, these are very, very complicated matters. And in fact, when you talk about the amount of
when you have 12 million people who are already unemployed in America, and you add another 700,000 to that number, I mean, that's huge.
And the impact will be different in different parts of the country. I think we all are seeing from headlines in this area that Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. are really going to be affected because so many people work for the federal government, particularly for the Defense Department. So some parts of the country won't feel that pain as much as what we're going to be seeing in this area.
And let me just say, in terms of information, we're in the same situation we have been for years now, which is different people are getting different types of information from different media sources. And
right.
So the whole country is getting completely different orientations as to what's likely to happen. And so no one ever ends up understanding anything. And plus, we have another crisis coming up. So it's hard to keep the crises straight.
There was an interesting poll that I'll talk about in a minute that came out of the Business Insider, which is not a liberal institution. And it was really interesting that I'll talk about in a minute. But let's go to the phones of 410-319-8888. And Carla, you're on the air.
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. Good evening. How are you?
Very well. Welcome.
And ladies.
Yes.
Hello.
I'm calling with regard to this particular issue. There was a comment made about tribal inability to work together. I tend to see it differently. I see it as a tribal unwillingness to really work together to resolve issues. And I also want to know why the Congress people, those 535 people, still get to draw a paycheck when they're asking other people to sacrifice. They don't need to have any of their money. It all needs to be withdrawn. If we start with them, because they work for us as citizens and as taxpayers, perhaps some of this budget shortfall can be filled with their paychecks first.
Well, and in fact...
Right. I wasn't laughing at you, Carla, but I was laughing with you.
Yeah, I think the caller really has something there. If the sequestration is used to motivate people to act, why wouldn't pay cuts for Congress have the same effect? I think that's a perfectly reasonable question.
But Congress would have to vote to cut their pay.
That's right. That's what happens when you have people voting for their own pay.
I don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah, they left that out of the agreement, didn't they? That one didn't occur to them.
That's something, parenthetically, that's something that media can push for, to ask, account for that. I mean, again, I think that issue doesn't come up, but there's no reason it couldn't come up.
The media is just reporting who said what yesterday. I mean, that's really all we're left with. If you want information now, you have to go to the editorial page and the op-ed page. like so often at the New York Times, the information in their editorials and in, let's say, Paul Krugman's column, you may agree or disagree with the point of view, but there's information there. And I always think, why isn't this being hashed out in front in series of front page reports on the front page? There's more information on the editorial page, and on the front page, it's who said what yesterday.
And I always think, why isn't there a clash of these interesting opinions? When you have Paul Krugman and Samuelson on opposite sides of the issue, why can't somebody, you know, have a clash of these ideas to see, you know, what the better position is?
Yar?
Well, I'm hearing this, but newspapers are businesses that want to sell those newspapers.
Uh-oh.
And if they were filled with front pages that were nothing but debates about sequestration that nobody understands, and nobody will buy the paper. So the front pages and much of the papers are for general consumption. The editorial pages are for the policy wonks, the eggheads, the people who really want to know the reality of what's going on in terms of public policy. So the news hole and the editorial pages are serving different audiences.
When you have a when you have an entire country talking past one another, it seems to me that you've got to be able to have the clash of serious people discussing serious issues. I mean,
they go to Charlie Rose's show, not to the front page of a newspaper.
Yeah, I was watching the other day when George Will was talking about the sequestration, and he made the argument that agencies that are being cut 5%. I have received a 17% increase over the last couple of years. Now, I'm not saying that's a dispositive point, but what I'd like to know the answer to that. Just forgetting my position on that, forgetting one's position on that.
No, I agree.
I'd like to see a good clash on that.
I completely
right.
agree.
Yeah.
And by the way, it's not like you don't have sequestration articles on the front page, because you do. It's just that they're all, well, here's what Boehner said and here's what,
right.
you know. And I can't believe anyone still cares what – forget which party – I can't believe anyone still cares what anyone said yesterday, because none of it leads anywhere. It's just
part of just covering the gamesmanship.
I know.
Rather than the substance, and it's easier.
It is easier.
Yeah. To do that.
And it is news. It's just not very interesting. After years of this, it's not very interesting news, in my view.
And I agree with you that it's not very interesting. I read it because I feel that I have to. And I think there are a lot more people who prefer to read about you know, somebody's paternity suit or something.
Well, you know, this is this is analogous to people who write on politics and just cover the horse race.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you know, it's an easy point to cover if you don't want to deal with the sophisticated component of the substance of issues.
That's correct. And unfortunately, that is the way so many of our young people who are trying to get into the communications world see things. They aren't seeing that there is more to be done than to be the first to get the most gossipy information out there, that there needs to be more focus on some of these deeper issues. And I have the hardest time trying to persuade my students to read the newspapers, to try to even read these, what little there is of depth about these more complicated issues. They look at me like, you've got to be crazy. They'd rather talk to me class when we were discussing how the Harlem Shake has taken over everything and lost its meaning from what it originally was to what it is now. I had a very lively conversation, but when I tried to get us to talk about sequestration and budget matters, I got glazed eyes.
Among your students?
Among my students.
Do we think, and then we'll go to the phones here again, Hank, you're the next caller up, is that the media solely, or is it also that I think that people in America are at a certain point with politics where they just don't feel that they have a sense of ownership, they don't feel that they have a sense of involvement or power within it, that it makes no difference what people think or say, that Congress is going to go do what it does, which is usually people perceive as being not very much, as being deadlocked. That people don't feel – you hear the word sequestration, but people don't feel it at that moment about how it's going to affect their own lives.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Every term I begin my persuasion class by saying to my students who are all 22 years old, I say, I just hope you all understand that we're in the process of taking – your money and giving it to people my age. And if that's okay, and you keep voting for such people, and I keep voting against such people, but that's kind of interesting.
Now, but you're saying that as a fact, but it's just your opinion. People might disagree with that fact.
People might disagree with
I
that.
I do, but...
But, it, yeah, but it gets them engaged. You know, they kind of do a little
right,
jump.
Right, right, right.
And they kind of get interested in it, and they may say, well, that's not the whole story, but they'll research it. I mean, when students learn about these issues, they can become interested in them. But you've got to have somebody make them salient to these people.
It's hard to see what conversation is going on right now in the public square that a young person would feel the ability to jump into, aside from who's going to win the next election, which, of course, is something we all understand that people do get involved in. But the budget discussions—
Some people don't even see why that's relevant.
No, I understand, but at least you know what's going on. Now, with these budget discussions, it's hard to picture, if you're a young person, what is the hook? There's no discussion.
You know, a perfect example, I could just say a perfect example of that is during the election when Romney talked about the fact that 47% of the public is dependent upon the government. Now, that's an interesting point. Now, he's correct or he's incorrect, and you can debate that. But the major issue on that is, he's really in trouble now having disaffected 47% of the public. The major point is that correct? Is it an oversimplification? Is it wrong? Let's talk about the substance of that claim, not just, ooh, he's in trouble now.
Well, that's one way to look at that.
Yeah.
I think that is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it, some people looked at it, was that was the divide in America. That spoke directly to this corrosive divide in this country. I mean that was part of, and that's part of what we see now. I think we have come to a place in America after ending segregation and the war in Vietnam and environmental thing awareness coming to the fore, women's equality coming to the fore, that we see this divide has erupted and it's just gotten deeper. It hasn't gotten shallower. And I think that's part of what is frustrating. I think it's frustrating. I think that's a dynamic that's
I think that to some extent there are macro issues. And I think one of the macro issues that I was referring to is, and it also deals with sequestration, and that is dependency the major chasm between left wing and right wing today in America. And it's more interesting to discuss the substance of whether that is a viable argument than to discuss, if you say that, you're going to lose an election. I mean, that should be discussed at some point. But the interesting thing is to look at that substantively. Is it the case that the American electorate is becoming more and more dependent on government, and does that therefore lead to more progressive candidates winning office?
Well, where are we going to have this discussion? I think the starting point is that the people seeking office or seeking to retain office don't want to have those discussions.
Right.
They want to remain in office, or they want to attain those offices in the first place. So the game, again, becomes winning office and holding on to office. It has very little to do with what is best overall in the long term for the American people.
We're going to take a brief break, and when we come back from this brief break, we're going to go to Hank, our first caller up, and I want to ask our three panelists today, what are some of the things you think that we are missing here in the press and the issues that should be out there that are not being wrestled with? 410-319-8888 number here. Hank, we're going to come right back to your question. Don't go away. Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are here with E.R. Shipp, Associate Professor and Journalist in Residence here at Morgan State University in the Department of Communication Studies, winner of the 1996 Pulitzer Prize. Dr. Richard Vatz is in the studio. He's Professor in the Department of Mass Comm and Communication Studies at Towson University, author of the book The Only Authentic Book on Persuasion. He's a blogger for Red Maryland. And Bob Summerby, editor of the Daily Howler. I would say this is the 20th anniversary of the Mark Steiner Show. This week will be 20 years we've been on the air. And Rick Vatz and Bob Summerby were some of the earliest folks on here. Have been around for 20 years doing this show, which is pretty scary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. 410-319-8888 is the number here. And Hank, you're on the air.
How are you doing today, Mr. Steiner?
Very well, Hank. Welcome.
I am blessed. My question, my thing is this, right? Okay, I'm listening to them saying that they're going to put a 7% tax on gas, right? Hello, can you hear me?
Go ahead.
Okay, this is what I don't understand. How are you going to put a 7% gas tax, a 7% tax on gas, right, when you can't control big corporate business to tell them how much they can put on gas because you let a restriction go the year before Katrina or a year after Katrina where nobody, the one gas company can charge $3 and directly across the street they can charge $4.25. Right, which is very unfair to the people who have to get around, people who want to take vacations. And then on top of that, you've raised taxes on soda, water, cigarettes, and other municipalities, but yet you have not raised anything on alcohol. Right? Why are you scared of big alcohol?
Yes, they are.
Them now? Right? I really think that, yes, now after sitting back, good living, how these politicians are playing, everybody needs a 2-year term. After the 2-year term, you're done. Right? If you want to play these games, well, I've been doing this for you, I've been doing that for you. You get two terms. 2 terms to do what you do. If you ain't got what we want done right in the first and the second term, you out of here. Because these politicians play too many games with other people's lives and other people's money. And then another thing, yeah, if you want to make some money, if you really want to make some money, you can legalize marijuana. You realize the money rate that you're spending. Look, just for marijuana, you got 2 different grades of marijuana. You got your regular grade
okay.
and your high grade. Your high grade of marijuana can cost you $125.
You're past my level of expertise now.
Okay, Hank, thank you. Hank.
You're spending $30 to $7,000.
All right, let's take off some of these. Actually, at 6 o'clock, we'll be talking to two members of the Maryland House of Delegates who are introducing legislation to legalize marijuana and put a $50 tax on an ounce of marijuana. They're introducing that. It'll be debated. We're going to hear from them about why they're doing that.
Why would we want to tax the biggest cash crop in America? That's the part that I can't imagine.
So we'll see what they have to say. And the bill also says that you can have allowed to grow 3 plants in your home legally without being taxed. So
may I say a word about taxes?
In a moment. And so I think Hank does raise some issues here. I mean, in terms of the there was a front page piece in the New York Times today about the subsidies that businesses are getting around America, federal subsidies, for the wealthiest corporations to build buildings. And these are the subsidies that are usually given for public works projects. Instead, Goldman Sachs and the Barclays Center in Brooklyn and other places are getting the same write-offs and costing billions of dollars.
Well, let me give you an example of the kind of discussion that doesn't go on in this society. Except during an election. During the election, we were trying to figure out why does Mitt Romney, who makes a lot of money, why is he paying a much lower tax rate than other people that make a lot of money? And it was a substantially lower tax rate, and it became a big deal. It became a big deal, and it was quite a bit of discussion only because we had an election going on. Now we're past the election, and the two parties are fighting over more revenue or not more revenue. And that whole discussion, how many people like Mitt Romney are making a lot of money and paying a much lower rate of taxation? Now, these are some of the so-called loopholes that Obama has proposed eliminating that the Republican Party doesn't want to eliminate. There's no discussion of that going on. That's something I'm that ended. We only discussed it because it was tied to a personality, and we got to bang the personality around for a while, and it was part of our election. And now it's just gone. There's no discussion of anything. Obama talks about loopholes, and Republicans say you've had your tax hike, and that's as far as it gets. That's the end of our discussion.
ER?
I agree with you that way. But we are trained to somehow put a human face on some of these issues. So it's easier to put a human face on that issue of discrepancy in tax rates when you have an election because you have people there. But it's very hard to do that on a daily basis otherwise. I wish we did more. I'm an advocate for finding ways to make people understand what's at stake for them in many of these issues, particularly now that we're talking about fiscal matters. But we don't do that. We'd rather focus on the latest gaffes that someone has made. or we'll focus on
we love gaffes
that come to light from their childhood, but we won't get at the real substantive issues because we don't think that that sells.
Let me just say, first of all, that E.R. Shipp and I are 100% in agreement on this, and it's and also parenthetically, if I may, that my two favorite guests of all the years you mentioned 20 years. I think E.R. Shipp and Bob Somerby are my two favorite guests to be on with, if I just may say so. But let me make a point about...
Especially since we're here today.
No, but I don't say that. I don't say that about other people.
No.
So let me just say this. Let me give just a representative point about taxes, those who like to soak the rich. The representative case is the 1990 George Mitchell luxury tax, which he wanted to tithe everything from jewelry and yachts, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And what happened was is that it threw a lot of salesmen and managers and people who worked in those areas out of work. And so he came back and he said, I want to drop my support for that tax. You know, people think that there are no consequences to anybody when you raise taxes, and the fact is that there often are, and we forget these things.
So why are you bringing this thing up? We're actually getting into a debate on taxes.
Well,
actually,
we were.
Because there are plenty of studies that show the exact opposite of what you
just
said.
Well, I don't except the fact is that people think that you can just tax more and more without any consequence. But eventually, capitalists, when you take all their money, they can't invest. And so there is a point at which when you tax them, you're taking away their ability to hire more people, to invest more people. Small businesses in this country, we never talk about the taxes on small businesses, the fact that small businesses are taxed at the same rate as individuals. And I think that it at least deserves an examination. And in the debate, every time that issue came up, the people who hosted the debates, the moderators, said, let's get off that topic.
Well, they didn't say it that way necessarily.
No, they didn't say it that way. No.
But I think you're onto something. Often, those who are moderating our programs, our Sunday morning programs and others, aren't that well-versed themselves in some of these deeper issues. So we only get a shallow, lowest common denominator kind of take on these matters. There needs to be some forum that more of us deem credible than we currently have. People who focus on these issues don't all read the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times, whatever. They don't trust them. People are now gravitating towards parts of the media spectrum that they already know they agree with. So it's very hard to even have a serious discussion in so-called serious news outlets because we don't all agree on who to believe anymore. That's a sad consequence, I suppose, of the multiplication of so many news outlets now that we don't have any few that we can all trust to lead us in this discussion.
And I think that's true. And one of the things I think we're going to have to leave the discussion here in a few minutes because we're about to talk to Sherrilyn Ifill about the Voting Rights Act and what happened in the Supreme Court last week. But I think that it is critical. And I think the problems also when you sit in this chair, my chair, is actually getting people in who can talk about those things without it being full of invective.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Having a lively, serious discussion of disagreement without invective is very difficult to produce in this world.
And just let's talk about the Voting Rights Act. I was really struck the other day. A very rational liberal blogger, Kevin Drum at Mother Jones, did a post about the fact that apparently Mississippi's black voters have a higher turnout rate than black voters in Massachusetts, which is a kind of a counterintuitive, a surprising fact. Justice Roberts brought it up in the arguments last week.
I saw that.
I was just stunned by the comments. All of which, speaking as a liberal, let me say we liberals can't discuss something like that without immediately going hyperpartisan, proving there has to be something wrong with that. There has to be some reason why black voters are turning out more in Mississippi. It must be because – and it has to go back. I mean, I was just really struck by – and, of course, this is all over the internet on various sites – that the hyperpartisanship – and as the liberal world has grown in the last 10 years, we have become a very hyper-partisan tribal community. We used to laugh at Fox for being so tribal and partisan. And boy, We are really very similar.
So what I want to do is invite all three of you, and we'll invite somebody else back for an entire hour to kind of look at this in even greater depth in the next couple of weeks, maybe if not next week, the week after, because it's a pleasure to have the three of you on the air with us.
Great. I wish I could be there to discuss the Voting Rights Act, but I'll be writing something about that soon.
All right. E.R. Shipp, who is a professor here at Morgan State University in communications and journalism. She's our journalist in residence here at the university, winner of a Pulitzer Prize in 1996. Dr. Richard Vatz, professor for the last 20-some years in mass communications and communication studies at Towson University, author of a book, The Only Authentic Book on...
Of Persuasion.
Of Persuasion, excuse me. And Bob Somerby, editor of the Daily Howler. Good to have all three of you with us.
Thanks.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you all so much. We are going to take 30 seconds and a little quick 30 seconds. Come right back with our guest, Shirley Neifel, who is president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund.